Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
We must look beyond the object to the meaning behind it, says folklorist Barry Tolkien, to the meaning it has in a shared community of values, in a culture. Tolkien is the director of the Folklore and Ethnic Studies program at the University of Oregon and is a member of the National Endowment for the Arts Folk Arts Panel, which he formerly chaired. Here, before an audience at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks, Tolkien talks and gives anecdotes about American Native folklore and material culture.
If I could choose a subtitle for the talk I want to give tonight, it would be something like this, The Meaning of Things in Tradition. I think this is a particularly important subject for museum people to be interested in, but for anyone who's interested in the objects like the baskets and the canoes and the objects produced by any culture, not simply Native American culture, we are too often accustomed to looking at these objects as if they are only objects, putting them in the proper glass case with the proper white card telling what they are, what color they are, in case we're colorblind, how long they are, and so on. But we're not so talented at talking about the meaning behind the object or the meaning behind the tradition through which the object was produced, and perhaps the tradition which even explains why the object exists to start with. I want to start by telling an anecdote because it's one that illustrates the means by which we can sometimes discover another dimension to what we're looking at when we simply open our ears and listen to the people who are producing the objects we're looking at. I'm referring to something that happened on our campus a few years ago when a number of our local craftspersons decided it would be exciting if we could bring a Native American basket maker to campus as a visiting professor and accord that person the facilities and the honor of a professor and give that person some advanced students who knew about baskets to work with for a couple or 3 weeks to see if we couldn't have something like an intellectually exciting as well as practically exciting class on basket making, a master class, you might say. We encountered a woman in southern Oregon, a Yurok, a part Yurok woman, who was thought of as one of the best basket makers there, Mrs. Matt. And we managed to get an adjunct visiting assistant professorship for her for 4 weeks on our campus. And she came to us and became a member of our Faculty of Architecture and Allied Arts for about a month. And she had about 20 students sign up for her class. They were all people who knew very well about how to make baskets and who had studied that process very widely. But they wanted to get contact with a particular artist and get some perspectives they might not gain any other way. Mrs. Matt started in on them, and she started teaching them. When I visited the class about a week after it started, I found no baskets being made, but the class sitting around looking puzzled, singing songs together under the direction of Mrs. Matt. When I went back at the end of the second week, they looked even more puzzled because they were still singing. And some of them stopped me after the class and said, could you talk to Mrs. Matt? I don't think she really understands that there are only 4 weeks and she just keeps teaching us these songs. Finally, at the end of the third week, they actually tackled her directly and they said, look, this is fine. We love these songs. It's wonderful. But gee, we signed up for this so we could make some baskets and find out what you think about baskets. And here we are singing a lot of nifty Indian songs. When do we get to the baskets? Well, it was Mrs. Matt's turn to look puzzled. She paused for some time and then said, well, that's what we're doing, you know. And then the class took its turn being puzzled and said, well, but when do we actually get to do this stuff? And she said, well, you can't do the baskets until we've gone out to get the materials. You can't just go out and take the materials. You have to sing to the plants. You know, those are our relatives. And she said, you might not think of them as your relatives, but I certainly do. And I'm not going to take a gang of you people out into the woods and just have you grabbing stuff all over the place. I mean, I have to keep making baskets the rest of my life with the cooperation of these trees. And she started to get a little testy about it, and they backed off and said, okay, fine. She took them out that weekend. We got a university, a couple of vans. And they told me later that they felt a little sheepish standing out there in the woods singing, but they went through with it because, for one thing, she wasn't going to go any further unless they did. But also they had begun to admire her as a person who possessed some way of looking at baskets that they had never suspected in their lives. So they came back to the classroom. Monday of the last week, she started in on some more songs. There were something like three or four songs that they had to learn. They had to learn the translations of the songs, and then they had to promise that they would hum these songs to themselves while softening the materials in their mouths. Softening the materials, of course, made them more pliable, easy to work with. But as she pointed out to them, you had to be thinking about putting these baskets together while you were doing it, because thinking about it was just as important as what you were doing with your hands. And what the songs reminded you of were all the interactions, all the responsibilities of people and baskets and plants in the food supply. And when they said, but what does this have to do with basket weaving? She finally said, look, a basket, after all, is a song that's been made visible. And they were obviously stunned by that kind of information. That was such an insight for them because they had never thought of it that way before. She went on to tell them that as far as her tribe was concerned, what you did with a basket, especially what a woman did with a basket, was to go back and forth between the food supply, like the berries, the salmon, whatever it might be that nature provided, and the people in the family or in the tribe. The basket is a kind of an intermediary, and it's usually under the control of the women. Not always, but usually so. The women are seen as the nurturers of these people. They start when they breastfeed their babies. And they graduate, you might say, to a larger position when they bring food back and forth with the baskets. One of the reasons we sing both to the baskets and for the baskets and to the plants, Mrs. Matt said, is that singing is what we do to reciprocate for the food that comes the other way and goes into our mouths. We sing and nature gives us food. It's reciprocational. Someone said, well, does that mean if you don't sing, you won't get any food? And she said, no, you can still go out and get food. But who would be so crude as to deal with nature that way? It's like taking food from your grandmother without asking. It's like accepting food from a stranger without giving some kind of gift back in response to the fact that you're receiving your living. She felt that producing a basket without singing was like producing a skeleton, a useless object. But what I suggested to a group of people this morning here at the museum is that it's precisely that skeleton or that object or that fossil that we often, too often, I think, see in the glass cases of a museum. Basket, Navajo, 1920. Basket, Pomo, 1915. Museums try, but very often museums are not in a position to go back to the old basket makers and get perspectives, such as we got without even asking, practically, from Mrs. Matt. That is, we certainly didn't know that we were going to learn those things when we invited her to our campus. But it's that kind of thing that I mean as the meaning behind the object. For many Indian people in those tribes in the West and Southwest who produce baskets for those reasons, for many of those people, it's easy to argue, easy to understand, that when they see a basket or use a basket, it's not only a utilitarian object, but it touches off a tremendous range of meaning and response that has to do with nearly everything in their lives, a powerful symbol of a lot of things. Although those people don't stand around and give lectures like I'm doing about symbolism. They don't need to. They operate with it all the time. And many times it goes unsaid because it's so obvious. When we take those objects and try to look at them, it's our job, I submit to you, to find out what some of these things are behind the object. And to realize that not every tribe or every village has the same meaning for even the same object. It becomes very, very complex, and I think it's well worth the search, well worth the quest. I've asked people about this business of singing for years, ever since Mrs. Matt did that to us in Eugene, and I keep finding people who say, oh, well, of course you sing. One man at the Umatilla Reservation said, it's not only all the things you've just said, because I recounted the same anecdote to him. He said, we also sing to the baskets and among ourselves so that there will not be anger in the food we eat. And there's still another dimension. You see, the basket being somehow symbolic of all those kinds of interactions among people who live in small, crowded places and who have to look out for all the kinds of tensions and stresses that can break loose and ruin the kinds of unity and cooperation on which a tribe survives. Many tribes have stories about baskets, and that goes for the groups here in Alaska as well as down our way. One of my favorite stories is a Lummi story that talks about Indian girls going out to gather berries in their baskets. They've made the baskets ahead of time. They've sung to them while making them. They've taken their baskets out into the woods, and the berry picking is so good that the baskets are full almost immediately. And one of these five girls says, look, we've got plenty of berries. Why don't we just eat them and then fill our baskets up again? And the other girls say, well, no, that's not right. You know, what we're told is we're supposed to always bring food back and share it with others. And the first girl says, well, look, the bushes are loaded with berries. There's no problem. We'll have plenty to bring back with us. So they say, well, all right, and they eat all these nice berries. And they take each of them has two baskets, and they take the baskets and hit them against their sides to knock all the stems and leaves out. And then they go back to picking berries again, and immediately the baskets are full. And so the second girl says, well, let's sit down and rest and have some more berries. There's still plenty here. And so it goes on through to the fifth girl. Each time they stop and they bang the baskets, they sort of hit them against their hips to get all the debris out. But on the last time, they can't stop. They just keep hitting their sides like this with the baskets, faster and faster and faster, and finally they fly away. They became the birds. And you can still hear them when they fly through camp. They're still going like this, trying to knock those baskets out. Well, I think it would be a mistake to put that story in a children's book, as many Indian stories unfortunately wind up, and say, this is an interesting story from the Lummis about the origins of birds. Because I don't think that has anything at all to do with the origins of birds. It has to do with what happens to people who don't bring the food back and help nurture their tribe. Notice what happens. They are turned into birds who, as we all know, are involved in a lifetime of bringing berries back one at a time to their kids. That's about all they do. It's like being punished by spending their entire lives bringing berries back. But not only that, every time you hear a bird go through camp, it reminds you of that story. That is, birds remind you of the obligation to feed your family. And those birds remind you of the story. The story reminds you of your responsibilities. It's a story about people and not about birds. And it uses baskets as an element, a very strong element of relationships between people. And I'm always happy when I see museums do, as this museum is trying to do, use live people in the demonstrations, use stories in the booklets, stories from the people themselves, to illustrate what all these things are about. Because without the cultural backgrounds, we often are stuck just with the bones. And the bones are sometimes attractive, but nowhere nearly as interesting as the entire culture, or as much of the culture as we can get. Objects which come out of some kind of tradition have not only the artist's own meaning in them. I suppose every artist tries to express himself or herself as fully as possible. But traditional items always have another dimension, a dimension of shared values among the members of a group, whether it's a family group that feels a certain way about a recipe, or a national group that feels a certain way about a certain national food, like lefse at Christmas time for Norwegians and so on, or whether it's a kind of a craft that has to do with producing sleds or toboggans or snowshoes or baskets or whatever it may be. Usually what distinguishes traditional art, and this distinguishes most of what we call Native American art, is that dimension of a shared community of value. So that the performer, if I may call the person that, the artist who is building the toboggan, the sled, telling the story, building the snowshoes or making the basket, is performing essentially, at least in a traditional community, for other people who already know what that stuff is supposed to look like. Instead of trying to break loose and do something entirely new, the person addresses the performance to the group of people for whom those kinds of things have been meaningful for a long time.
We'll hear more from University of Oregon folklorist Barry Tolkien on the underlying shared meanings of objects, of songs made visible, in the next program on Chinook. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profile. Portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Most traditional artists reflect the values of their culture rather than individual needs, says folklorist Barry Tolkien. Tolkien, a National Endowment for the Arts folk arts panelist and director of the Folklore and Ethnic Studies program at the University of Oregon, shared his ideas in a lecture at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks. This program is the second of two programs of excerpts from Dr. Tolkien's speech.
Most artists the world over see new media and new tools as a chance to do art better or more fully. And I think there's no essential difference in traditional art except that what the word better means may have to do with cultural values rather than the personal inclinations of the artist entirely. Consider a couple of examples. Quill work, Go Among the Sioux, was the way that most of the Sioux people represented geometrical patterns in years gone by. When they were able to have access to glass beads, they very readily adapted. Partly, of course, because this was a new medium, it must have been exciting and interesting, but if you look through a retrospective collection of Sioux art, what you'll notice is that the beads allowed them not to stray away from tradition, but to intensify their tradition. They were able to use the same designs, but go further with them. Some of the same colors, but now they could use shades of colors and contrasts which weren't available to them in the dyes that they could use with the quills. That is, rather than moving away from the concepts that are represented by quill work, they were able to deepen them and extend them and intensify them. We know that Navajo rugs and Navajo silver work have only been around for a little over 100 years, and yet a lot of people think of those as traditional work, and they get upset when a Navajo weaves the word Valentine into the middle of the rug, or as a rug I saw one time that had a gold medal flower seal in the middle. And people say, well, that's not very traditional. Well, the rug itself wasn't very traditional for the Navajos. They learned how to weave them, and they feel they can weave anything they want to into a rug. It's the traders who keep telling them, look, keep weaving all this stuff that looks really rectangular, because that's what the white folks think you Indians do. In fact, some traders will tell the Indians to weave with bright colors, because the whites expect that. And in fact, I know some Indians who produce stringed beads for white consumption, tourist consumption. They're strung together with glass beads and with juniper seeds, and that's an old custom for the Navajo, the juniper seeds, which I won't go into right now, but they put all these bright glass beads with them now, and I asked them how they started that. And they said, well, you know, we sell a lot of these to whites now, and they just love those bright colors. But most of you recognize that that's a stereotype that a lot of whites have about Indians. Well, where's the truth in all of this? We have to sort of get behind the scenes and find out what people really do when they do it. And we find that most of these traditional artisans will do what they want as long as it still makes sense within their own culture. The Navajos, for example, when they first came to the horse, or when the horse came to them, they adopted the horse very readily, no hesitation, because the Navajo model for reality is movement. And a horse lets you move a whole lot faster and farther than you can move on your own 2 feet. They're not dumb. It's not just that a horse is easier. A horse lets you be more Navajo than you were before because you can move more. And when the pickup truck came along, that became the thing because you can move even farther and faster and longer on a pickup. And in addition, a pickup has round wheels, and the circle has always been of a particular interest to the Navajos, especially moving circles. In fact, the modern Navajo slang term for pickup truck is shilink, which means my horse. I don't think that's any accident. What the Navajos are looking for is movement, and they don't consider themselves eroded or acculturated because they drive pickup trucks. They consider themselves even more Navajo than they were before. If you're ever down there and you've got a CB radio in your car, just turn it on and listen to the Navajos on their CBs. They're talking in Navajo, and you can call unless you're in dire distress in English, and no one will answer. What the CB radio has allowed for is an extension of the Navajo language, which they consider a part of the reality of the world. The Navajo say that the world and the reality of the world is continually recreated by our talking. Imagine what a CB radio means to somebody who believes that. I mean, that's even better. You see, that's not erosion, that's intensification of who you already are. Up on the Yukon River, I met an Eskimo man named Waski Walters, Mountain Village. I don't know if any of you have met him. He carves nice little objects out of wood that he finds down along the shore of the river. He uses a little Dremel tool, and he said that when he taught a class in carving at the local school there, some of the teachers said that, well, it wasn't quite traditional, and they didn't know if it should be done that way. And he asked me if I didn't think that, wasn't this universal? Don't people always look for better tools? Doesn't it allow you to be a better carver if you can carve the kinds of things that your mind can conceive of better than you can with a rusty old knife? He said, what do they want us to do? Go back to bashing things with stones? And in fact, he said, they also gave me a lot of static because I didn't carve ivory. And the teacher said, gee, you know, you're an Eskimo, why aren't you carving ivory? He said, well, my dad carved ivory, but you don't find a lot of ivory right along here, along the Yukon, and so I carve wood. And he said, you know, my son there carves in soapstone. He picked that up in school. And what I noticed was, looking around the house, is that the son is carving the same kind of thing in soapstone that Waski Walters is carving in wood, and they're very similar to the kinds of designs that his father carved in ivory, some wild-looking little monstrous characters that he carves out of a knot. And he says, all you have to do is look and see what character's in there, and then you cut away everything that doesn't look like that. Now, that's an idea that I've heard attributed to people like Rodin and Michelangelo. That's a widespread idea in the world of sculpture. And somebody gave this man static because he wasn't using a primitive tool. You see, somebody wasn't watching what was happening to the tradition. Instead, they were watching the objects. And we very often get led astray by that. They don't feel limited. And in fact, when they find that something will sell, that, in fact, often lets them stay in business so they can continue to be artists. I think every artist knows that feeling. I would argue that these innovations and development, then, are not to be seen as losses or erosions of tradition, but rather as an intensification of concepts. And many of these concepts are central to the cultures in which they are expressed. It's very much like the phrase, God bless you, when you sneeze. There was a time in European history when many people believed that if you sneezed, your soul might leave your body momentarily and the devil could snatch it. And so, to make sure that didn't happen, somebody would say, God bless you, and that would scare the devil back far enough so that you could get your soul back and survive somehow. Now, if somebody here sneezes, if I sneezed, I bet several people in the audience would say either God bless you or Gesundheit, which just means good health. And if I stopped and said, do you still believe that old stuff that my soul just popped out of my mouth for a minute? And you'd all say, no, but it's, you know, it's the sort of thing you say to people when they sneeze. You see, that thing's still functioning because we still believe that God bless you or Gesundheit as a sign of human interest in someone else's health is a valid and functional thing that relates us to each other. And it seems to me that folk art, traditional art, can also function on that level very meaningfully, even though the entire system that once supported it may not be there anymore. It may be in tatters, but as long as the material objects keep being produced by those same people, I think I would argue that there's still some kind of deeper functional meaning than the mere utilitarian or the function as tourist art. Some customs, of course, are just gestures. Gesundheit, perhaps, is a gesture. I say Gesundheit to people whether I hope them that they're healthy or not. A lot of customs are just gestures. We hear a lot about our responsibilities to an ecosystem, an ecological system around us, which has been affected by our presence, maybe as well, good and bad. There are maybe some more of some animals and less of some kinds of plants, and it changes from year to year. I think we also need to recognize our responsibility with respect to native arts and native cultures. Even if the whole culture isn't intact anymore, we need further understanding, because we always discover that there's something there behind which we hadn't seen before, which means in turn that we haven't understood as much as we could have. We need enhancement, I think, and nurturing of the natural contexts in which these arts flourished and in which the art continues or can continue to have meaning. And I guess what I'm saying is that the ecological system, the ecological context for this kind of art is not the museum, although it's nice when museums can lend themselves to a better understanding of them, but the real live context out in the world in which the artist can be creative, in which the culture can feel that it actually nurtures these arts and can feel the sense of their importance. Because I think it has to do with more than native people, it has to do with all of us. One place we can start with, I think, is with basic respect for all other cultures and their networks of meaning, what meaning means to them, and what their concepts of creativity are, and what their aesthetics are. We could use some instruction in these areas because they will enhance our own concepts, as well as enable these people to go further in the attempts to maintain a perfectly valid set of traditional arts. I think what we need to do as people who are interested in the arts is to try to look beyond the surface of any object we see and try to pick up its meaning. Native people are aware of this all along, that non-natives very often see the surface and don't see what's behind it. About 2 months ago, I heard from a Navajo friend the following joke. I have to give you a footnote about it first. Navajos don't like to point at live objects. They don't point at rainbows. They don't like to point at people, animals. They don't even like to point in a direction if they think somebody's likely to be over there. Instead, they point this way with their lips. If you say to a little boy, "Where's your father?" he'll say, "Lego, way over there." Lips. And other tribes down our way point with their chins, like this. But the Navajos just purse their lips like that. And it's a very gentle kind of a gesture. Well, this Navajo friend told me the story. A white man bought a very expensive hunting dog and decided to take him out hunting. Some kind of English setter or something like that. Paid $500 for him. But he didn't have anyone to go hunting with, so he went over to his Navajo friend's place and he said, "Hey, let's go hunting. Have you got a dog?" And the Navajo said, "Well, yeah, I've got a couple of dogs. Have you got a hunting dog? I mean, you know, a dog that's not going to embarrass us out there." And the Navajo said, "Yeah, I got a Navajo hunting dog." So the white guy says, "Well, go get him and let's go hunting." So the Navajo goes out and he finds this old mongrel sitting there. And he says, "Okay, come on, let's go." And this old dog just sits there. So the Navajo finally picks him up and throws him in the truck next to this noble, expensive dog who's sitting there. The Navajo dog falls asleep immediately, and they go driving off, and they go hunting. They get out to the hunting area, and the white guy says, "Look, I don't like the looks of that dog very much. He's going to spoil the hunting here. Let me try my new dog out first, and then we'll see what your dog can do." And so he goes out with his brand new English setter, and they walk out there very carefully, and the setter, or I'm not even sure I'm describing for you the right kind of dog. It's a dog that points, anyway. The dog goes into a very nice point, and a bird flies up, and the hunter shoots him. And they go along, and the bird goes into another point, and the bird flies up, and the hunter shoots it. And he's hunting for 20 or 30 minutes, and he comes back with about a half dozen birds. So he says to the Navajo, "Okay, your turn." Navajo grabs the dog, throws him out on the ground, kicks him and says, "Okay, let's go." And they walk out into the same area, and the dog just sits there and looks around. And the Navajo just stands there watching the dog, and suddenly turns around, and a bird flies up, and he shoots it. They walk on a little further, and the dog sits there and looks around. The Navajo stares at his dog, waiting for him to do something. A bird flies up, and the guy shoots it. And after a half hour, he's got about 12 birds. And when he comes back, the white guy is just furious. He says, "You know, I paid $500 for this dog, and that mutt of yours just sat there, and you got twice as many birds as I've got. That's real coincidence or dumb luck or something." And the Navajo says, no, I told you, he's a Navajo hunting dog. He's what we call a Navajo pointer. You got to watch his lips real close." He was trying to say precisely, and I think said it much better in that very short form, what I've been trying to say in this rather long form this evening, and that is you've got to look real close to see the difference between a native attitude on something and some other attitude. It doesn't mean that one is better than the other, and it certainly doesn't mean in my book that natives have to go back to an old or outmoded way of life. We're not talking about anything backward or regressive or old-fashioned. We're talking about what we allow and encourage people to bring with them as they come on into the modern world with all of us. And this goes for everyone, I think, in America. Everyone that has this problem. Everyone, I think, has this concern. Unless we're willing to abandon the richness of this multicultural heritage that we now participate in, I think we can't afford not to look real close and find out what's going on behind the object like that Navajo pointer. You see, one threat on the physical level is that if we don't encourage these arts, we might indeed eventually lose the Athabascan basket. But I think what would be even worse than that would be the loss in depth and richness in culture that's available not only to Athabascan people, but to the rest of us. I believe as people interested in the arts and in culture, that's a loss that we should not allow. Thanks very much.
Professor Barry Tolkien of the Folklore and Ethnic Studies program at the University of Oregon in a talk on American Native folklore and material culture at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.